add my welcome to the welcome that you've already heard. I'm glad to see you here. A little bit of orientation, just in case you haven't been with us for a little while. We're going through the Bible a little bit at a time. We had made it most of the way through the book of Judges when we took a short sojourn into 1 and 2 Corinthians to follow up on a piece of information there. We came back last week and finished with Samson, and so today is a rare day. It's a day when we start a new book. So we're looking at the book of Ruth, and what I'd like you to do is look at the last verse of Judges as we begin. If you have your Bible, if you have a print copy, it should be just across the page or maybe a page before. If you have an electronic one, you'll have to jump a little bit, but it's Judges 21:25 is the verse I'd like you to look at. What does it say? Two things. What's the first thing?
Israel, no king.
No king in Israel. And what else? Okay. I'd like you to turn briefly to Deuteronomy chapter 12. Deuteronomy chapter 12. And find verse 8. What did you just read? There was no, in those days there was no king in Israel, and
everyone
did just as he saw fit. Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 8. Here's what my translation says. Follow along in yours. Moses is speaking to the people, and he says, "You must not, when you get to the promised land as implied, you must not behave then as we are behaving here today, each of you doing what he himself sees fit." You see a small problem here? What did the law say? The last thing you do when you go into the promised land, make sure you don't just do whatever you see fit. What are all the people doing? Whatever they see fit. Okay? First verse of Ruth. First verse of Ruth. Try to say that without lisping. Okay. Mine starts out with two parts. The first part is short, the second part is long. The first part is, in the days when the judges were governing. What does yours say there? In the days when the judges ruled, yours says. Okay. Next little bit.
There was a famine
in the country. Now, I want you to just pause there for a moment. Just pause there for a moment. Because I want to take you someplace before you go any further. Has there been a famine in the United States?
Yeah.
You bet. What's the big one that came within the last century? It was nicknamed the Dust Bowl. Okay? What was the outcome of people who were experiencing famine? Crops wouldn't grow. Animals they were trying to raise were dying in the fields. What did many of them do? Picked up and moved. That's what's about to happen here. However, I do want to mention something to you. I don't know what you read, and I don't know what you read for fun, but I read all kinds of things. And this week I saw an article that said, "Do you think human beings can really change the climate?" And the subtitle was, "Well, we've already done it." And then they had a story. It was a story I didn't know about. There was some obscure guy back in the 30s working for the Department of Agriculture for the feds. And he came to some people in the Roosevelt administration, people higher up the food chain than he was. And he said to them, "I think I can stop the Dust Bowl and reverse it." And he did. And nobody knows about it, according to this story. What he did, millions of square miles, or whatever, across the center part of the United States, and he went out and planted trees. The number of trees he planted compared to the area was ridiculously tiny. But he planted them strategically in certain places in rows, never this way, but whatever the direction of the wind was, he planted them perpendicular to that and planted them in certain places. And he had this all mapped out. He said, "If I plant these trees here, it will no longer blow the dust across three states. It'll stop there. And once that stops, lots of other stuff will stop." And it turned out it worked. One of the few things that the government has done, and none of us know about it. I don't know if that story is true or not. I just read it this week. But it seemed to me interesting that I came across that against the backdrop of this story. Now, who got up and moved? Mine says, a famine occurred in the country, and a certain man from
Bethlehem,
which is located in the tribal area of
Judah,
went. Dash, he, his wife, and his two sons, dash, to live in the plains of Moab. The man was named
Elimelech.
Now we're going to practice that. Lots of L's, lots of M's, Elimelech. Elimelech. And his wife was named
Naomi.
Okay, the Haglers like that name, I think. And two sons. Who were the two sons? Malan. And one translation uses a K instead of a CH, which gives you a hint of how it's supposed to be pronounced. Kilian. Kilian. Malan and Kilian. Certain man from Bethlehem of Judah went, he and his wife and his two sons, to live in the plain of Moab. The man was called Elimelech, his wife was Naomi, and his two sons, Malan and Kilian. Semicolon. I'm still in verse 2, I think. They were so-and-sos from Bethlehem of Judah. Then it goes on from there. What's that little word? Do you have that word in here? Starts with an E? It looks like it would be Ephraim, which is one of the tribes. If Levi is taken out, then you split Joseph in half and you got Manasseh and Ephraim. It looks like that, but look closer. There's no M in there. It's got a different pronunciation. Ephrathite or something like that. Everybody got it? If you read in King James, the prophecies about Bethlehem being the place that Jesus would be born, that prophecy doesn't say Bethlehem. It says Bethlehem Ephrathah. That's the word. So this seems to be either another name for Bethlehem, maybe an older one than might have been given by the Jewish people, or maybe the name of a prominent family that was there.
Because, you know, it says Ephrathites of Bethlehem.
Mm-hmm. So my grandfather grew up in Upper East Tennessee in a little area of land, maybe 3 miles this way by 4 miles this way. There was a bend in the river. It was actually named for this. You can look it up. It's McFeeters Bend if you want to. It's got several E's in McFeeters. One bend up the river from Sequoia where they tried to put the big nuclear plant and never finished it. McFeeters Bend. So the river went like this. Bays Mountain was from the river like this back to the river. So you couldn't get over the mountain for a good part of the year. You couldn't get across the river for a good part of the year. This was a little isolated farming community. Fairly level, not too rocky, so, you know, families. So if you knew of the Olivers from McFeeters Bend, or the Skeltons from McFeeters Bend, or the McFeeters from McFeeters Bend, although they died out pretty early, I think it means something like that. I'm not certain. But it does not mean Ephraim. It's not like they're from another tribe living in Judah. I want to make sure you see that. These are people from Bethlehem. Okay, so far? Now, before I go any further, I want to make sure of one more thing. I want to look as we go through for inference. Would you tell me the difference between deduction and inference? Deduction means
you figure it out.
You can figure out something and it's probably right because all the evidence is there. What's inference? You're not sure, but there's some implications in there, and you're pulling those implications out. We use the word inference for that. So here's my first question of inference. How old were the boys?
Well, they had to be old enough to marry.
Not yet. They weren't married when they left. And the fact that they weren't married gives me an inference. They were probably not yet old enough to marry. Next question. How old is old enough to marry? Got an idea? 16 to 18, probably. And these guys are probably younger than that. They might be 10 or 12. That's sort of my picture. They could be 6 or 7. My picture is probably 13 or 14. Probably almost old enough to marry, but not old enough to marry yet. Let's say 15 just for fun. Okay? Because if they were old enough to marry, they'd be married. The way the culture of the time was, that would have happened. That mama would have taken care of that. Okay? So, where are they going? They're going into Moab. What do we know about Moab? Esau had settled in... I'm suddenly losing the... Esau had settled in one place. Lot's descendants had settled in another, and Moab is one of those two. And I don't think Esau is associated with Moab. I think he's associated with another place. But these were people groups, population centers that were not taken over during the... And they're living sort of on the edge of Israel. The next country's over, if you will. And there was constant enmity between those. If you go and read through Judges, sometimes it was Moab coming from that side. Sometimes it was Philistines coming from the other side that was terrorizing the country. So this was not necessarily a place that was friendly to people from Israel. And yet that's where they were going. Why did they go there? This is simple, but it's another inference. They had food. And it was close by. And it wasn't Egypt, which would probably have been a little too far. Okay, so here they go. And I want to know, take a look at between verse 3 and verse 4, what was the first thing that happened when they got there? You are not going to like me for what I'm about to do, but let's see. What was the first thing that happened when they got there? Answer, we don't have a clue. We don't know if the writer is telling us everything. There's not a time frame here. So the first thing that's reported is that daddy dies. But that's not necessarily the first thing that happened. And here's what I want you to see. In my translation, it says in verse 2, they went to the plains of Moab and they settled there.
Mine says remained.
They,
which makes me think.
Yours said remained. Mine says settled. I want to stick with settled for just a moment. I'm going to look for another inference. The next verse says Elimelech dies, right? But the verse before says they settled there. What would it take for people from Israel to feel settled in Moab? Do you think that would happen in the first month? I don't think so. It took us about 8 years to feel like we were settled in Richmond.
Mine says, verse 3, during the time of their residence there. That lets me think that they had set up.
Well, verse 2, I think, is implying that. And I don't have that piece there. But maybe that's being picked up from verse 2 in your translation. Does the tail end of verse 2 have something parallel to settled? Yours said
no.
They remained there.
Mine says continued
there. Okay.
Mine says
lived there. The word settled, I think, has an inference to it that I believe to be valid. I'm figuring at least a year. Maybe a year and a half has gone by. They found a place to live. They found some work to do. They found some land where they can grow some food. They've gotten to the point where, okay, we can see ourselves being here a while. And then daddy dies. How old were those boys? Maybe as young as 10. Maybe as old as 15. And what happens when daddy dies? They have to take over the responsibility of things. And that's a huge thing to ask of a kid who's 15, and it's even more to ask a kid of 10. We don't know for sure how old they were. But I think you should not think of these kids as being 28. I don't think you should think of them as being 28. I think you should see daddy's death as a disaster. I think you should see this as the next smack, the next of the seven waterfalls. I can't talk about the sermon always in the first hour because half the group hasn't heard the sermon, but you've heard the sermon, right? It's like the second of the waterfalls, right? It just keeps coming. It just keeps coming. The first one was the famine back there, and picking up and leaving was a big deal. And they've picked up and left, and now daddy dies. And daddy's the one who's been making the decisions and guiding them. Suddenly daddy's gone. And these kids have to step up to maturity really quick. Now it then says that they got married. Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. This is verse 3. And she and her two sons were left. These, that is the two sons, this is verse 4, married, mine says Moabite women. One was called Oprah. Okay, so that's not, we're going to all agree that that's not Oprah. We're all going to agree that that's not Oprah. I think it did.
But I misspelled it.
I've heard her say her mother made a mistake.
Yep. Misspelled it?
Yeah, misspelled
okay,
it.
Okay, but it comes across as Oprah. Okay, well, that's even better. I didn't know that in the first hour. Barbara didn't chime in with that at the right moment. But Orpah is what it says, and the other was called?
Ruth.
How old were they?
Probably 15.
What do you think, man? What do you think? How young?
13.
I think 13, 12, something like that.
Old enough to be married in that culture.
Old enough to be married, yeah, 12, 13 maybe. If you think 18, I think you're too old. I think if you think 28, I know you're too old. I think that. Now, what does it tell you about the families of Orpah and Ruth? Starts with N. Nothing. What can you infer? Very good, but that's not a... That is not an inference. That is a deduction.
You can infer there were no children. There were none mentioned.
Well, there are no children in Naomi's family yet. I don't know about Orpah and Ruth. I assume had not been married before. But I want you to take a step further. Who in Moab would be willing to marry some kid from Israel? Somebody that either was desperate, which I don't think fits what I read, but is possible, or somebody who didn't care. That implies apathy, which I don't think fits either. I'm guiding you. You feel yourself being guided.
Orphans.
These two girls appear to be people who would be open and welcoming to people that the rest of the society around them might well shun or reject. I believe that's an inference I can reach for. It's possible they were desperate, but I think the evidence suggests that's not so. But it seems like, what does it say about their families? Nothing. Any inference you'd care to go for? Their families might not have been all that happy about this. It certainly would not be a surprise if you hear that.
Well, you could infer that they were upgrading their position in society. So maybe their families were happy.
Yeah, let's take a time out on that one.
How long do they have to live in Moabite to become Moabites? Does that mean, because they're called...
I believe they would have been illegal immigrants. Because I believe they probably wouldn't have been able to apply for citizenship and get it. Maybe they would have been legal immigrants with a green card. But I doubt they had green cards in those days. But I want to take you a step further. When I was in graduate school, we were living in Gainesville, Florida. We had some very, very close friends. The husband in that couple was in medical school at the University of Florida. Medical school is expensive. And this kid was trying to work his way through medical school. And after about a year, he realized, I'm going to graduate with so much debt, it's not going to be funny. And he started looking at options. The option he found was he joined the Army. So during break times, he went off to whatever, Fort Sam, Houston in Texas, and went through medical training and all that. And so when he graduated with his degree, he became a captain in the Army, and he went into the Army for 3 or 4 years. And gave the service back because they had helped him pay for medical school. Okay? His first assignment was to one of the most exotic locations you could ever imagine, Arkansas. The year was, I think, 1973. He had his year of internship and maybe a couple of years of residency before he went in. So it may have been 1975. What was going on in the world in 1975 that would have affected Arkansas? It's not likely you're going to guess this, but I want to give you the chance. Nice try. No, that was a little bit earlier. That would have involved the Army at Fort Chaffee. A huge refugee camp for people coming out of Vietnam. And he spent a couple of years working with refugees from Vietnam. What do refugees look like? Is that an upgrade? I don't think so. These guys were refugees. that what they would have owned would have been stationary. It would have been the house. It would have been the land. It would have been whatever else they had. And they left all that behind. I don't see, maybe, but I don't see this as, oh, the rich foreigners came in. I think they came in with some resources that let them, you know, buy some things, but they wouldn't have been, I think, inference, I'm guessing, but I don't think they would have been rich. So I see a hint that these two young women, these two girls maybe, might have had an attitude that was a little different from the attitude around them, an attitude that would let them be a little bit more opening and maybe somewhat welcoming to these strangers to allow this to happen. There's no hint that her family disapproved, but there's not anything that says that they did approve, and you can kind of read between the lines, maybe there was some strain there. They lived there, mine says at the tail end of verse 4, for about 10 years. And then, what happened?
The sons died.
The sons died. At the same moment, on the same day, we don't know. Close together in time, it's implied. What you got now? Maybe the girls are now early 20s, but they're wives. All the men are dead. No mention of children. We are now talking desperation. We've now hit at least the third, maybe the third and the fourth waterfall in the image that Travis gave you in church. What did they do? Whatever resources they brought with them have likely gone. The people who can do the physical labor are gone. This is desperate. My translation says, verse 5, she, that is Naomi, verse 5, Mahlon and Chilion then both died too, and Naomi was thus bereft, good verb, bereft of her two sons and her husband. She then decided to come back from the plains of Moab with her daughters-in-law, having heard in the plains of Moab that God had visited his people and given them food. Okay. Let's unpack this just a moment. My translation said she decided. So Naomi makes a decision for herself to come back from the plains of Moab with, what does it say? With her daughters-in-law. Big step. Big step. She has decided to come back. Come back implies what? That the writer is standing in Israel watching this happen in Moab and showing them coming back. There's a couple of translations that say return, and that's, I think, a little more vague. But if come back is right, then this is being said from the standpoint of the writer standing in Israel sort of watching this and watching them come back.
What was the distance?
100 miles, maybe. 100 miles, maybe. A big deal, but not impossible. Might have been a little less, might have been a little more. Pull out a map, and if your Bible has a map at the back of it, pull out a map and look sometime. But I don't think it's not 500 miles. It's nothing like that. God had visited his people and given them food. Verse 7, so with her daughters-in-law, that's the second time my translation has used that phrase, with her daughters-in-law, she left the place where she was living, and they took the road back to Judah. Verse 8, you have the sense that as they're beginning to walk back, maybe they've been a day's journey, Naomi suddenly becomes overwhelmed with the thought of what's going to happen to these two women when they get back to Israel. The ostracism they're likely to face, the prejudice they're likely to face, the rejection they're likely to face, and you almost sense a change of heart. She decided to go back with her daughters-in-law, but you get to verse 8, and it looks like she's changed her mind. Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you to your father's home?
Mother's.
Why would it say mother's home?
Because the men died earlier.
Maybe because those men died too. Maybe there was a general death of some kind. Also, it's possible, go to your mother's home because your mother's the only one you still have a relationship with. Your daddy's written you off, but maybe your mama's still got some connections. I don't know which way to read it. The inferences, I think, allow you to read either of those, but it seems to me those are the two that you could read.
It says parents.
Does it say parents? Mm-hmm. Okay. I've checked a couple of translations. Do the rest of you? The ones, there's enough that say mothers that I think that may be accurate. And if that's accurate, that it's saying something. I can't be sure what, but it's saying something. But listen to how she says this. Go back, each of you, to your mother's house, verse 9. May the Lord show you, and she uses one of the most powerful words in the whole of the Old Testament, hesed. Hesed in the Old Testament is parallel to agape in the New Testament. It means faithful love, and that's the way it's translated in mine. May the Lord show you faithful love. What does yours say at that place?
Kindness.
May the Lord show you hesed. May the Lord show you faithful love as you have done to those who have died and to me. She can't bear to speak the name of her husband and her children right then. She's hit so many waterfalls that it's almost... And you can almost hear a break in her voice before she says, and to me. The Lord grant that each of you may find happiness with a husband. She then kissed them, but they began to... Mine says weep, which produces no sound.
Mine says lifted up my voice.
Mine says wept loudly.
Wept loudly.
So this is mourning at a high level. They both began to weep loudly and said, no, we will go back with you to your people. Go home, daughters. This is the first time Naomi is quoted using this word. Go home, daughters, Naomi replied. Why come with me? And then she says something that makes almost no sense if you don't know something of the culture of the day. And I'm going to just read now down through verse 14. And we'll come back and talk about this. No, daughters. Go home, daughters. Why come with me? Have I any more sons in my womb to make husbands for you? Go home, daughters. Go, for I am now too old to marry again. Even if I said, I still have a hope, I'll take a husband this very night, and I'll bear you more sons, would you be prepared to wait for them until they were grown up? Would you refuse to marry in that interim for their sake? No, daughters, I am bitterly sorry for your sakes that the hand of the Lord should have been raised against me. They started weeping loudly all over again. Orpah then kissed her mother-in-law and went back to her people, but Ruth stayed with her. What was that strange little interlude? What was that? It's fairly simple, but it's going to be the key and the hinge for the whole of the book. There was a custom that said you do not want the family name to die out. So, if a brother dies, then you take his wife to be your wife, and the first child from that marriage would be considered to be the child of that dead brother. And that child would then inherit all the things that had used to belong to your brother. If a brother's not available to do it, then the next one out, a cousin. If that one's not available, you keep going out until you find somebody ready to do that. Okay? Was that more or less what you were going to... Okay, that's the picture that you had. It's called Kinsman Redeemer, and it becomes one of the most powerful concepts in the Bible.
And how long ago do you think that died out? I mean, it wasn't like a long
It certainly lasted through the kingdom period. It does not seem to still be there coming out of the exile period. The multiple marriages, the poly marriages, don't seem to have presence after the exile or even into the exile period very far. The kings had multiple wives, but somewhere down there that died out. Everybody still with me? So Naomi's saying, you need brothers for Malan and Kilian. That has to come from me. Even if I started tonight, you'd have to wait at least 15 years before they're old enough. You're willing to wait 15 years. And besides, I'm too old. It's not going to work anyway. I don't have a husband. And if I did have a husband, I'm not likely to have any more children. If I had been likely to have more children, I'd have already had them in the last 10 years. Everybody see the picture? So, Orpah turns and goes back, Ruth doesn't. And what Ruth says has become a staple, a central feature of so many weddings, it's not funny. This was not said by a wife to her husband or a husband to a wife. It was said to a foreigner daughter-in-law, to an alien, different culture mother-in-law. And it's gorgeous, and it's beautiful, and it's moving. In the King James, the first term or an early word in this phrase is entreat me not. What does your translation say there? Don't urge me. Entreat me not. Don't urge me. Is there another translation? Mine says don't press me. Don't press me to do what? Don't press me to leave you. Don't press me to stop going with you. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Most of the wedding ceremonies stop there, but Ruth doesn't. Where you die, I will die. This is a lifelong commitment. If you were to die, I wouldn't go back to Moab. I'm allegiance to you. And there I will be buried. And here's this. Let me pause for a minute before I read the next little thing. Go back to where is it? Yes. Look at verse 15. Look at verse 15. Naomi says to Ruth, look, your sister-in-law has gone back. Gone back to what? Two things. Her people and her God. God's, yours says? Mine says God, singular. Gone back to her people and her God. Go home too and follow your sister-in-law. And Ruth refuses and begins to say this. And notice when you get to the middle of verse 17, she is no longer speaking of her gods. She is speaking of the God of Israel, the God that has been revealed to her by her interactions with Naomi over the last 10 years. May the Lord bring unnameable ills on me and worst ills too. That's the form of an imprecation that is often before an oath. If anything but death should part me from you. Verse 18, seeing that Ruth was determined to go with her, Naomi said no more. The two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. How far had they gone? Probably 3 or 4 days. How long did they stay in Moab before they made the decision to come back? Probably a month or two. What were happening to their circumstances during this time? The men were gone. The resources were limited. They probably came back to Bethlehem looking like refugees. They didn't come in a limousine. They came in rags. And what's the reaction of the town? Your says stir. Mine says the town was astir, set the town astir. There is one translation in the first hour that I thought was brilliant and wonderful, and I'm waiting for it. Do any of you have another word?
Excited.
Excited, yours says. That's not yet the one that I thought was so fantastically wonderful. Anybody got it? Set the whole town abuzz. I thought that was great. What does that mean? You could hear them talking. You could hear them talking. And what are they talking about? It tells you some of it. Their arrival set the whole town astir, set the whole town abuzz. And the women said, can this be Naomi? And some of them said it to her face. Are you really Naomi? And her response was, don't call me that. Call me what? Mara, which means?
Bitter.
Because the Lord has dealt with me bitterly. Count the waterfalls I had to fall down. Verse 22, this was how Naomi came home with her daughter-in-law Ruth the Moabitess on returning from the plains of Moab. They arrived in Bethlehem at the 1st of October. Is that what it says? No. At the 1st of April. No. What does it say? At the beginning of barley harvest. If you are in a place where you depend on the food to keep you alive, you keep track of when the food comes in. If you're going to have barley harvest, what does that mean? Some people are going to go out into the fields and
harvest
the barley. This is a deduction. This is not an inference, right? Okay, and that's where chapter 2 begins. Chapter 2 begins with the writer telling you, hey, in the next little bit, watch for this guy. Who's the guy you're supposed to watch for?
Boaz.
And why are you supposed to watch for him? Three reasons. Maybe four, maybe five by the time we get through. Number one, he is a close relative of Elimelech. What does that mean? A Elimelech appears to have had no brothers, or maybe this was a brother, I don't know, but the inference is not. This is a potential kinsman redeemer. And the whole of the book hinges on how Boaz acts in that role. In acting in that role, he gives us a model of how Christ acts in acting as our kinsman redeemer. Our elder brother saves us. He redeems us. This is a very early model picture of that. Joseph was a different one several generations before. Naomi had a kinsman on her husband's side, well-to-do out of Elimelech's clan, mine says. What does yours say in place of well-to-do? Great wealth. A man of standing. Does great wealth and a man of standing always go together? No, it does not. There was a man in the little town I grew up in called Franklin Parks. He had the great wealth. He did not have the standing. He had Rottweilers around his house every night and bright lights, because if they were going to come and shoot him, he wanted to see them coming. You know how he died? Shot in his bed by somebody that came by those Rottweilers, and they still don't know how. It's a mystery to this day. He did not have both. Boaz does. He is both well-to-do. Yours says a man of great wealth. I think there's one translation that uses the word prosperous. Yours says worthy, which I think is a variation on a man of standing. A man of worth, I think, is probably what that means. Yeah, so that's the way that one took that second part, that man of standing. I don't have the man of standing. I don't have those two pieces. I just have well to do. But I think your translations that pick up those two sides, prosperous and a man of worth, those are the best two I know to translate that. His name was Boaz. Now, come to verse 2, as if you haven't seen verse 1. And here's Ruth. And Ruth, the Moabitess, says to Naomi, what does she say? Let me go into the fields and glean. Glean, mine says. Yours says pick up, and that's explaining what the word glean means. If you go back to Deuteronomy, if you go back to Numbers, I think it is, there's a section that says, it's right there in the same chapter with love your neighbor as yourself. Love your neighbor as yourself is the summary of this part. And it says you will not harvest and then pick up everything that dropped on the ground while you were harvesting. If it falls on the ground, you don't pick it up. You leave it for the gleaners. And the word glean means picking up. And the implication, the inference is they were dirt poor. And she was looking for some food for her and Naomi. And she was apparently of sufficient physical ability that she could go out and do that. Let me go into the fields and glean ears of corn. Now, my translation says, in the footsteps of some man who will look on me with favor. How does yours render that part?
Behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor.
Uh-huh. There's one translation this morning that came from over here that a person had words that made it sound like, may I go out and find this in the footsteps of a person, in the sight of one with whom I have found favor. And this guy thought maybe this is talking about God's view and the view of a man sort of simultaneous. I think there's good in that. I don't think it quite fits what I read here, but it's an interesting idea. In any event, I think it simply means some man who will look on me with favor. What would be the other way that some man might look at her?
As an opportunity.
As an object to be exploited in any of a number of ways. That is a serious, serious undertone, and it makes there's a piece of this section that is ugly. It's really ugly. And I want you to keep your eye out for that. Let me go into the fields to glean, mine says, ears of corn. That wasn't possible because there was no corn there. That came from the Western Hemisphere and was transplanted back that way. It can't possibly mean corn. What does it mean? Barley, because it's barley harvest. So if you want to use the word grain, and I think there's two translations or three that do that, if it says grain, that's a better translation than I've got. When they use the word corn in a translation, they don't mean yellow and butter and on the cob. They just mean grain. She replied, that's Naomi, go, daughter, and she uses that term again that she had used back then. So she set out, who set out?
Ruth
did, and went to glean in the fields behind the reapers. Still in verse 3, chance led her to the field of Boaz. Boaz of Elimelech's clan, just in case you forgot verse 1. What led her there?
Her half.
Mine says chance. One translation says happenstance.
As it turned out.
Okay? I don't like to take issue with the Bible. I really don't. I would rather try to bring what I'm thinking in line with what I'm reading. But I think at this point, you need to see the writer with a twinkle in his or her eye as he or she writes that word and say, yeah, wink, wink, chance. I think that's what you should hear. And I think that because in the very next verse, it speaks of Boaz and uses almost the same terminology. Chance led her to a plot of land belonging to Boaz of Elimelech's clan. Verse 4, Boaz, comma, as it happened. Did you hear it? Chance.
It says, and behold.
Yeah, yours says, yeah, and behold, as it happened, had just come from Bethlehem. So what's your picture? Your picture is, here comes Ruth to the field, and here comes Boaz, and they're going to meet for the first time. If she had come the day before, they might not have met. If she had come the day after, they might not have met. Do you feel that?
Divine appointment.
Yeah. Except there's a small problem here. Anybody see the problem? Where are they? They're in Bethlehem, right? She returned to Bethlehem. That's what it said back up there. They arrived in Bethlehem, verse 22. They came back to Bethlehem, verse 19, back in chapter 1, right? Where are they? They're in Bethlehem. And it says, Boaz, as it happened, had just come from Bethlehem. How do you come from Bethlehem to Bethlehem? We got to go for inference here, guys. We got to go for inference. There's a little bit of happenstance, God's divine appointment. You know, it looks like it's just happenstance, but it's not. But we got to get past this. Yeah, where are the fields? Where are the fields? The fields aren't downtown. The fields are out there somewhere. And Boaz is a prosperous man. How many fields does he have? Probably several. I wouldn't necessarily go to lots, but I would go to several. Where are they? Are they all in the same place? Maybe, maybe not. But even if they're the same place, there might be a barley section over here and a barley section over there. And, you know, on a given day, he's in town doing business in town. He's out here. Who does he have out in the field? He has his workers. What do the workers look like? Men, nice try. Let's stick with that idea and see if it holds up. It doesn't. Men and women. Men and women. This is a fascinating little thing. This is not inference. This is deduction from what's here. Okay? I think he has workers that work here, workers that work here, workers that work here. And on a given day, he might not visit any of them. And on another day, he might visit two or three of them. He might be here at this time, he might be there at that time. This is inference, but I think I'm on a target here. Are you with me? Everybody okay? Verse 4, Boaz, as it happened, had just come from Bethlehem. Now, it's as if the writer is now saying, let me just open the doors and let you watch as he comes to the field. He comes up to the field. He looks at his workmen, his work people, my translation says later, because it picks up both genders. And he says, the Lord be with you, he said to the reapers. The Lord bless you, they replied. That's a great way for the boss to greet the workers on the floor. That was great. The Lord be with you, he said to the reapers. The Lord bless you, they replied. Boaz then said to a servant of his who was in charge of the reapers, to whom does that young woman belong? He has apparently noticed Ruth. Now, if you're a good boss, you know who your workers are. You look out there, you see the workers. There's Fred, there's Gladys, there's Emily, there's George. And, whoa, who's that? And this was a, whoa, who's that? Because Ruth apparently did have some looks to her. That at least is an inference I think I can pick up on. He noticed her right away.
Well, on the other hand, she's in rags, remember? I mean, she's
maybe
destitute.
Maybe.
And he hasn't seen her before.
Yeah.
He's been dead for a few days. He might not be dead, but that's our problem.
Boaz said to a servant of his who was in charge of the reapers, "To whom does this young woman belong? What is the word that makes your ear cringe?"
Belong.
How dare he, you say? What was the culture of the day? Every woman belonged to somebody. Some man. And thus, in the wedding ceremonies, in many wedding ceremonies to this day, who giveth this woman to be married to this man? That's a vestige of this. To whom does this young woman belong? Now, what I want you to notice is, this guy who's in charge of the reapers has quite a bit to say. You've read this, right? That was your assignment. You're off the hook because you weren't here. But everybody else, your assignment was to read all this, right? Okay. The head reaper, the grim reaper, maybe we should call him. No, we'll reserve that for another time. He says to Boaz, "To whom does this young woman belong?" Verse 6, and the servant in charge of the reapers replied. And the reply goes all the way through verse 7. The girl is the Moabitess. That should have been enough, but he doesn't stop there, does he? The one who came back with Naomi from the plain of Moab. She said, implication, to me, please, does yours have that word?
Yes.
Please, let me glean and pick up what falls from the sheaves behind the reapers. End of quote from Ruth. Back to the quote from the head reaper who is speaking to Boaz. Thus she came, and here she stayed with hardly a rest from morning until now. What has he communicated to Boaz? Number one, this is the person that the whole town has been yakking about. And probably we have too. Right? Foreman is maybe a good word for this guy, right? Grim Reaper just doesn't seem to have the right ring. Okay? She's that one. Came back with Naomi, and you know, you're kin to Naomi, you'll remember her. And then what else does he tell Boaz? How about that word please?
She's a hard worker. She's,
yeah, but before that, what about that word please? She is respectful of authority. Please let me glean. She's asking for permission. She's not making the assumption. The law gives her the right of gleaning, but she is not one claiming that right. She is asking for the privilege. And she is doing so respectfully. And maybe this is a little bit further out inference. It sounds like she's doing it with some humility.
Would that have been the same law?
Well, the question is whether an alien has the same rights as a citizen, which of course is a matter that's all settled now, right? We've settled with all those issues today. We don't have those questions anymore, right? It's the same questions. But for a foreigner to claim that right might have been presumptuous. And what I see is humility. That's a little bit of a stretch. Respectfulness, that's right there. And not seeking rights, but rather asking for permission and privilege. I see a humility that's in that. Paul?
You may have said this earlier, but being a Moabite, the Moabites and the Jews would have been enemies most of their life.
These would not have necessarily been automatically friendly relationships, correct?
But I just think in this book of Ruth, if you look at her life, knowing that she, going back where you were earlier a little bit, the fact that she would leave her people and come as a foreigner, even at least historically enemy, was a great risk on her part.
Correct.
And maybe that does affect some.
Well, I think the foreman is saying she did not come in with arrogance.
Right.
She came in with respect and humility. And then he says, thus she came, and here she stayed with hardly a rest from morning till now. And Chris, you were talking about that one. It shows what?
She's
not afraid of hard work. She's capable of hard work, and she's not afraid of it.
Do we know if gleaning was something that, it sounds like she's hard on the heels of the people that are harvesting. And she's working morning till evening, right? I suspect she could gather up enough for her next meal pretty quickly. So, but she stayed the entire day. Was she looking to store stuff up? Was she trying to manufacture a reason to see Boaz?
I don't think a reason to see Boaz was in her mind. I think that part of chance, from her standpoint, it was chance that took her there. From our perspective, we can see God's hand in it. But from her standpoint, I'll go over there. Okay. And I think that would have been all. But I think she was looking to store some up. I suspect they had been living in some place that somebody had let them live, but someday they got to start being self-sufficient, or at least taking steps towards it. Okay. The foreman finishes speaking. Verse 8 starts. Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen to me," and he uses the same word Naomi has been using. What's the word?
Daughter.
What's the inference? He might be older. Now, what he says ends, from my standpoint, in horror. Not that it could happen, but that it seems to be assumed that it would happen if Boaz doesn't take steps. "You must not go gleaning in any other field. You must not go away from here. You must stay close to my work women." This is where I see the gender mix in the workers. "Keep your eyes on whatever part of the field they are reaping and follow behind them. I have forbidden my men to molest you." Why would he have needed to say that? Because if he hadn't, they might have. It would not have surprised anybody. This is what happens to unprotected women. And that's a horrible thing to think. That's over with now, right? Women are safe all over the earth, right? I don't think so. I have forbidden my men to molest you. And this is the one that sort of blows me away. "If you are thirsty, go to the places my servant drink and drink from those pitchers." Ruth fell on her face, prostrated herself, and said, "How have I attracted your favor for you to notice me, I who am only a foreigner?" Boaz replied, "I have been told all about the way you have behaved to your mother-in-law since your husband's death, and how you left your own father and mother and the land where you were born to come to a people of whom you previously knew nothing." Those two things he did not get from the foreman, the way the story is being told. He was listening to the buzz. "May the Lord repay you for what you have done. You are now here. You are supporting Naomi. You are seeking food for her. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge." And she says, "My Lord, I hope you will always look on me with favor." We're going to stop right there. That exchange is so powerful. All that's going to come out of this is validation for this moment. Her prayer was that she would find a field to glean in where she would come and find favor from the man who owned the field. This man has now looked on her with favor. And what is her prayer now? That she would always find favor in his eyes. Beauty of that story is powerful. I encourage you to read the rest of the book. I encourage you to come back next week and let's do a little more. Let's have a quick word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we thank you for stories like this, stories that down inside them we realize are full of pain, full of dislocation, full of despair, and full of terror. And yet at the same time, you are finding a way to put things together in a way that brings good out of it. Those of us who have read ahead in the story know that you're preparing a king. You're preparing for a family that first produced David and then produces Jesus. We find it wonderful that such a simple story could begin such a great thing. We look forward to next week when we can study some more. We thank you for your presence with us. We thank you for our church where we can worship you. And we pray that you would be with us all throughout this week. We ask in Jesus' name. Thank you.